Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Get around the radio, kids. It's time for Strictly Confidential. It's the homosexual agenda on steroids, putting the dominionists and the loyal Bushies and the rest of America's underbelly on notice that the GLBT community is simply not going to take it anymore. So, just like gay kryptonite, here's Peter Godbold.
Good evening, America, and good morning, world. Welcome to Book, Chapter, and Verse 163 of Strictly Confidential. I am Peter Godbold, and welcome to the LGBT version of Conversation Radio exclusively here on the Working Class Supported Head On Radio Network. Also brought to you in part by Coal River Mountain Watch. Stop by crmw.net, Coal River Mountain Watch, and see for yourself what mountaintop removal is doing to West Virginia. Thank you for making Strictly Confidential a part of your day. One moment, I have to make a minor adjustment for the studio here, and that will only take a sec. Here we go. There you go, Bob. See if that's enough. We have a little gain issue there. Today is, in fact, Thursday, July the 10th, 2008. So if you are listening shortly after 9 p.m. Eastern time on a Thursday, that is July 10th, 2008, you are indeed listening to a live show, and you're welcome to call in and participate with myself and with the guest, whom I will be introducing shortly. The show site is strictlyconfidentialradio.com, and it is there that you'll find links to all of the guests and to the audio archives from past shows. You'll find links there also at strictlyconfidentialradio.com to our chat room, which is active as I speak. There, I'm in the room, and keeping an eye on things. It's one of the ways you can participate in the show. You'll find links at strictlyconfidentialradio.com also for Strictly Confidential's MySpace page and links to help you locate the music that you hear on the show. And you're also going to find there a link to the Head On Radio Network main site. And it is there that you can find out about all of the other progressive programming on the Head On Radio Network, as well as a PayPal button to make it easier for you to support listener-supported Head On Radio Network. If you'd like to participate this evening, we'd love for you to do that. The toll-free line is 877, the number 4, Head On. That translates into 877-443-2366, 877-443-2366. That is toll-free. If you have unlimited long distance, you could use that. That's area code 304-658-3333. Again, that's 304-658-3333. Both those lines ring in West Virginia. And I do try to check the email during the course of the evening. Email arrives to Peter at headonradionetwork.com. That's Peter at headonradionetwork.com. So you have several ways to participate, via email, via telephone, or by joining us in the chat room. You'll find links for all of those at strictlyconfidentialradio.com. I have to laugh a little bit about the exit last evening. If you want your listeners to come back, a sure way to do it is to stage your death in a radio show. Oh, my stars. Last evening we were just closing up and just about to ask Cynthia Manley to play the last chorus for us. And I had a run-in with a Dr. Pepper and could not get a word in. And I went silent and had to type into Bob in production chat to go ahead and run the exit theme. I'm unable to speak. In any case, we recovered from that. But I know many of you are back to see if I really did stage my own death last evening. In fact, the rumors of my death are greatly exaggerated. Tonight on the show, we have none other than Vincent Capretta. Now, Vincent is back, and he has not one but two dance club hits in appearing in drag. Capretta is doing two of Gloria Gaynor's disco classics, I Will Survive and I Am What I Am. They're on a new Summer 08 release on Ecstasy Records, a compact disc, CD release. Capretta is probably best known for charting high-energy dance tracks and music videos in the late 80s and the early 90s. Examples would be his number one Playboy Channel Hot Rocks music video, Puerto Rican Sex, that was in 94, and the homoerotic Stormy Weather, that was in 96. Vincent is no stranger to controversy. Vincent became the target of a controversial mail fraud scandal by protest of the Roman Catholic Church. That was in the late 80s and sent him to a three-year stint in federal prison where he was better known to the fellow inmates as Pinky, but he bounced back from that. He now holds a Bachelor of Arts in Sociology, a Master of Science in Administration, an ABD in Doctoral Studies of Academic and Industrial Psychology, and he is currently pursuing a Master of Arts in Ancient and Classical History degree. Vincent Capretta is also known as Father Anthony Capretta. Now, Father Anthony Capretta was ordained to the Sacred Order of Priests in Apostolic Succession in 2004 by the presiding bishop of the United Reformed Catholic Church International. And Father Anthony currently serves as the pastor of Community of Charity Reformed Catholic Church in Columbus, Ohio. If you'd like to find out more about them, that's at communityofcharity.org. Again, that's one word, communityofcharity.org. Vincent says in his website that he is openly gay and still looking for a life partner. So there you have it. We both love dance music. We both spent 3 years behind bars, and we both came back and landed on our feet. We are both HIV positive, and through it all, we've both held on to our faith. I'd say that makes Vincent a perfect guest. Wouldn't you? Vincent, welcome to Strictly Confidential.
Well, good evening. How are you?
Good evening, Vincent. I'm doing fine this evening. It's nice to have a chance to speak with you.
Well, I'm so honored to be on here, and really, when you were reading the intro to me, I even have to laugh about it myself. It's so crazy.
Well, Vincent, I have to tell you, it's a horse of a different color. You are, I think, eclectic is the best word I can come up with to do all of the things that you do. You're certainly not the average bear.
Well, I have several personalities, and that does get me into trouble once in a while.
Well, Vincent, tell us about Vincent when he was a little boy. How did you head in all these multiple directions? Did you come from a large family, or brothers, sisters?
Well, I grew up in an Italian ghetto in Cleveland, Ohio, and I come from not really a large family, a small family, a brother and a sister. However, we were in an area where we were taught to be Americans rather than Italian Americans. And at an early age of 7, I was put into music school, besides the regular education that one normally goes through. And so I spent most of my extra time, if I had any, studying both music theory and classical guitar. As a youngster. Now I'm just an old queen now.
It's an interesting start, though. Classical guitar is still a long, long way from high-energy dance and videos on the Playboy Channel and being involved in the church.
Well, I'll tell you, what happened was when I graduated from high school, I really didn't know what I was going to do, and somebody said, well, you sing, well, why don't you audition for the Conservatory of Music, which I did, and I was accepted to the Cleveland Institute of Music, which is a very fine school, and I studied opera for 3 years, and sang lead tenor for the Cleveland Civic Opera for 2 seasons, and from there landed a recording contract and abandoned classical music for dance music and popular music, mostly because of pay. I mean, they're very difficult to make a living in classical music, as you could probably imagine.
I see. And so in Cleveland, then, were you involved in some stage productions when you were studying opera?
Oh, many. I had lead roles at the Chagrin Valley Little Theater, at the Greenbrier Theater, the Mikado. I have a lead role there, Babes in Toyland, the Desert Song, all lead tenor roles. And I love singing in front of 1,000 people with a full symphony behind you. There's nothing like it. I mean, dance music can't compare to that sort of extra high that you have on to that sort of a live ensemble behind you. And I do miss it, but again, I just got caught up into this wonderful world of dance music, and it really is a whole animal of its own.
Well, Vincent, staying on the opera for just a moment longer, are there any outstanding scenes or productions that you were involved in that you're proud of that you remember still very clearly etched in your mind?
Oh yes, there was one when I was playing the role of Nanki Poo in the Mikado. I remember quite well. It was opening night. It was a sellout. We had an 8-week run, sold out every night. This was at the Chagrin Valley Theater. And during my ballad to Yum Yum, which was my partner to be in the play, during the wedding song, actually, my pants seemed to have come undone. And the safety pin that was holding up my pants, which was a Japanese wedding suit, slowly slipped down my legs. And I had athletic socks on, so by the time it reached the floor, the audience, they were in tears, screaming. The orchestra conductor's head was out of the pit, looking at me, and the whole show just came to a crashing halt. And so, you know, it was wonderful. I flipped open my fan, you know, and covered my midsection, and the curtains closed. And then the curtains back opened again, and we started to perform again, and we busted out laughing again. They had to close again. So, you know, it's that sort of live reactions that, of course, you know, with that sort of a production, and of course it's a tongue-in-cheek production to begin with, you just, you know, you miss that sort of thing when the fluky comedy, just those acts of nature happen, you know.
Priceless story, and one that I'm sure qualifies for the question I ask you if you vividly remembered an occasion, and certainly that's very clear as to why that would stick in your mind.
Well,
oh, my story.
The newspapers didn't allow me to practice, so, you know, it did hit the newspaper next morning because every reviewer in town happened to be there that evening. And
now, was this in Cleveland, Vincent?
And Cleveland is quite a cultural town. You know, the Cleveland Symphony is one of the best in the world. So, and the Art Museum, of course. So there really is a lot of wonderful culture there. And a lot of good food, too, if you like to eat like I do.
Vincent, how old were you during that time period and about the time you decided to leave the opera?
I was in my young 20s. And my first recording contract was in when I was 25. So it was between the age of 20 and 25 that I held these roles, which is relatively young for that sort of genre of performance. But now, like I said, I long to return to the stage in that manner. But again, you go where the spirit moves you, you know. And it moves me in places I don't even think I know where I'm going to be a week from now. I'm somewhere I don't even know, you know.
Yeah, there's the old joke about if you want to make God laugh, you tell him your plans. You've probably heard that joke before.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Were you out at the time, Vincent? Were you going to gay clubs or were you dating? What was this?
Actually, I was. I was out. Immediately upon graduating high school, I went to an all-boys private Catholic high school and secretly actually dated the student council secretary throughout my entire senior year. No one knew. Then, of course, then after that, I did come out, and I never really had a problem with it, with coming out actually. Of course, I think everyone has the family issues, which I went through. But again, on the psychological aspect of me as a person, I have never regretted it, and actually I probably flew out of the closet rather than just walking out.
Did your parents make remarks along the lines, oh, if only we hadn't sent him to music school when he was seven?
Well, you know, I had a feeling they probably knew many years prior. You know, I knew myself when I was five, six years old. I had a crush on Batman and Robin.
Oh, both?
And I
That's
knew...
good, but I hadn't heard that before. Go ahead.
Yeah, true. I actually knew that I was attracted to, you know, same sex since I was a young kid, but I really didn't know what it was. And even through high school, you know, the hormones weren't, they were just starting to flow, and I really didn't understand what was going on. And, but again, I never really had a problem adjusting as a person. And I know a lot of people do have that issue. I seemingly was able to, you know, move in other areas, move in other directions.
Well, interesting story. Vincent, I think that folks like us are actually fortunate when we realize our orientation at such a young age. I, too, was young when I realized that I never had any internal conflict over it. It was always external conflicts over the rest of the world.
It is. It's a difficult. The world is a cruel place in a lot of ways, and it's a difficult. You know, you do feel alone. I remember walking into my first gay bar, thinking I was brought there by a couple of friends that I had met, and I thought I was the only one in the world. And when I walked in there and saw 300, 400, 500 men in that bar that night, it just hit me that I wasn't alone. And it was from that moment on that I had absolutely no fear that I was, you know, alone, that there were many other people like me out there.
Was this in the early 80s then that you went into that large club with the 300 people?
It was in the early 80s, and it was the club that I actually performed in for my very first time in drag.
Fabulous.
I guess it was destiny.
I should say so. I remember the music of the early 80s quite well. That's when I was DJing. I was living in Portland, Oregon at the time. So the music of the 80s is I'm quite fond of. And you probably were struck by the music in the clubs. I would guess that you were anyway compared to what you're exposed to on the radio.
Absolutely, just mesmerized by the glamour and glitz of the whole disco era. Very much unlike what it is today. Today, it's nothing like it was back then. The whole ambiance of the disco era is unforgettable. And I mean, when you walked in, you felt like a star, no matter who you were. And the music and the lyrics and the music and the lyrics were so meaningful back then, and I think that's why I enjoy doing cover versions of the tracks from the 70s and 80s, because they simply don't write the lyrics the way they used to write them.
I happen to agree completely, and the energy has a different feel to it. It's there was something very special about those days that one can only fully appreciate had one had the fortunate events to actually live through them. Tell us about your first recording contract. You said that happened when you were about 25. This is a few years after you were going to the clubs. How did you meet the people that you were going to record with? Did you meet someone in the clubs who saw you perform? You did perform in the club, did you sing or did you lip sync? I'm very curious about how people move into the music.
Well, what happened was I was doing drag professionally, and I was in Boston. I was actually doing black females. Now, I'm a white male, and I was doing black females. I was a very thin, 135-pound little twink of a young man, and they were flying in dresses from Cher, actually, for me to wear. I was wearing Cher's gowns and being paid quite well. They wanted to run me for Miss Gay USA and all that business. And it was during that time that this producer heard me, who wasn't actually the producer that I later went with. I've been with many, but the initial producer had some original work, and that's how I started recording. But it was during that recording aspect that the decision was made for me to leave the realm of drag, per se, and go into the recording world. Now, of course, when I was doing drag, I was singing live. I was never mimicking. So I sound like a black female, as you've probably heard in some of my records. And I looked like one, and so it was a perfect fit. And so that's how it, you know, really, it's very difficult to chart what happens to you because it happens so fast when it does. You just roll with it. It just happens. And
I was going to ask about Cher's gowns, but go ahead. I'll ask you.
I'll tell you, they're heavy as hell. they were so beaded, I could hardly walk in them. That's the thing I remember about them most. And you know how thin she is, or especially how she was when she was with Sonny Bono. That's how skinny and thin I was. But they were heavy as can be. That's all I can remember about them.
Yes, they were heavily sequined back in those days. I happen to have a video stored somewhere in my hard drive of one of her shows, the Sonny and Cher show, and she's doing a duet with Tina Turner, which it's quite fabulous. It isn't very long, but they're both wearing so many sequins. One wonders how they can dance. So,
believe me, when they sewed these gowns, they used the best, heaviest pearls and gems they could find. So, I mean, these really were heavy. They used a lot of Aurelialis stones that are, you know, very sparkly rhinestones, as you know, but they're heavy as all get out. But again, you know, you just don't know when things happen, yeah. As I say, it's opportunities, they happen, the door opens, you run in. Most of the times the door closes before you can get there. But just that one time that the door opens, if you could just get in there at the right moment, then things start to move. And that's what's happening.
Vincent, did you encounter a lot of jealousy from the other performers that you were wearing Cher's outfits? That's got to be a showstopper right there.
Well, I can tell you, the first time that I walked on stage in Cleveland, they booed me off because they were so, the drag queens were so jealous that I was singing live that they booed me off. And I'll never forget that. And then from there on, I pretty much left Cleveland and started performing in other cities where they didn't know me. But yes, there is a lot of jealousy, just even amongst, you know, your co-performers, people who have aspirations of doing more than what they're maybe able to do or have the opportunity to do. And but again, I think. You know, you just have to go with it. You have to have that mindset that you can break away from the group and keep moving, even though there's a lot of rejection. And there really is. The music business is 95% negative. It's rejection. And if you can live through it, that's how you'll make it. And, you know, I've lived through it. I don't believe I've made it yet, but I've lived through it. And, you know, I just keep going, hoping that my message will keep reaching more and more people, and eventually, maybe someday, I'll get a big hit record. You know.
Well, so there are those that would say that jealousy and I don't know, some sort of a spiteful attitude is prevalent in the gay community. But what I'm hearing you say is that it's prevalent in the entertainment business and the music business altogether, and wasn't just an experience in the clubs?
It is. And I can give you another example. When I did my first show in New York, I'm sure you remember the Saint.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, and I was there for the music conference in 1986, the New Music Seminar. I had my first video that had come out called Fallen Again, and Casey Jones at the time had invited me to perform. I performed that evening with Pamela Stanley and Paul Parker, and the DJs were so, I don't know what their problem was, but they put me on the stage at 3 o'clock in the morning. It was still packed full of people. But they tied my microphone cord to the wall, so when I walked out onto the stage, it flew out of my hand and made a fool out of myself. And what they did is they actually switched the track that I was supposed to sing to one that I wasn't prepared to sing.
Oh.
So there's a lot of that sort of, you know, jealousy, and a lot of it is, you know, senseless, but it does occur. And I think it does go across the board. It has nothing to do with gender or sexual preference or anything of that nature.
Well, you know, it's a difficult thing to recover from because there's no one in the audience that has any idea that it's anything but you that caused all of it, that you were unprepared and that you, tripped over your mic cord. It's impossible to ever explain these things after the fact.
Absolutely impossible. And, you know, and it does bother you. I mean, you know, honestly, you know, when I was first starting out and, you know, that was my first premiere performance in front of New York audience, I was embarrassed, of course. But, you know, that drive that's in you or in a performer, any performer, when you have that drive as a musician, you have to set it aside to get on to the next project. And that's what I did. I just moved on. But you never forget. You never forget what happens to you.
Well, yes, to be sure. Vincent, you soon, moving from the what was the first track that you recorded? Was it The Fallen Again? Is that the
actually,
name of it?
Actually, the first track was called Panic. It was a very high-energy track that drew the attention of reviewers in New York. And from there, it was followed up with this track called Fallen Again, which a video was filmed to. And I was probably, what brought notoriety to it was probably the first openly gay music video ever produced that was dance-oriented. It was filmed on a college campus, and it centered basically around me falling in love with another male student in the classroom. And it caused so much controversy when it was released. It was released on Rock America that's what drew their attention to having me appear at the New Music Seminar in 1986. And, of course, back then, videos were just starting to hit the club scene, so it was really a great promotional vehicle for me.
Yes. I recall in the mid-'80s, I was working as a video DJ in Portland, and in fact, there were, in my experience, there were separate videos released for different markets. There was some of the big songs of the time. There was the video that was played in the gay clubs and the videos that were played in the straight clubs. It was almost a duality there, and probably more than just gay and straight.
Absolutely, I remember that well. All of the video companies that we did work with had the gay agenda and the straight club agenda. And of course, with dance music, you definitely want to break the gay agenda first, because dance music, as you know, starts in the gay clubs, and that's where it's tested. And if it works there, if you can please the gay crowd, you'll please the straight crowd eventually. I mean, you might be a couple years ahead of them, but eventually that song will make it over to the straight clubs.
Well, you were such a talented fellow that one wonders if you didn't write Panic. Did you write the lyrics or the melody?
Actually, I did not write the lyrics, but I did do the arrangement of it. I did not like the arrangement that was presented to me, and I thought it should be more electronic. And so I did, I was the vehicle behind the high energy aspect of it. The lyrics were written by Mark Luthart, who actually wrote some of my other releases that I had. I had two other videos that followed that one, and one was called Night Stalker, which was very high energy, where I was in uniform as a Navy personnel. So I've always done things to, you know, to tweak the establishment, you know. And so there was nothing better than a gay military man, right? And
not the time.
You know, you have to, you know, if you can't have it, you have to dream about it, you know? And but again, there are so many talented writers out there, and there's so much good music that can possibly be done. But as you know, the market today is so complex, and there are so many genres. It's so difficult to hit today. Whereas back then, you had disco, and you had R&B, and you had rock. Basically, those three. And you kind of fit into either one. Now you have all of these different genres of dance music it's difficult.
Yes, I could see where it would be. It's all various shades of gray. There's no real there. Everything's so fluid.
Well, that is the, you know, if you can get a hit today, and still I'm talking about from an independent label perspective. You know, of course, being an independent label, we're smaller. Our budget is smaller, and we don't have the sort of bucks to blow to either. It has to be a good release, or we're basically screwed. You know, and so we hope that when we put something out, that it's going to appeal at least to the target audience that we're shooting for, and hope that it will cross over elsewhere. Now, the tracks that have just come out seem to be doing that. They are reaching their target audience and seem to be actually moving beyond that, which is a good sign at this early stage.
Well, Vincent, I'm very impressed with your charting on the Mass Pool. This is in Boston. By the way, folks, if you don't know what that is, the Mass Pool DJ Association. It was founded in 1989, and it is involved into a highly regarded and professional DJ record pool. It was created by DJs for DJs. It is about DJs, and you've been doing it for 18 years, and you just popped into their charts as number 33, which is exceptional for a new release.
That is a very strong entry. It even shocked me. And that market is such a good market to chart in, because it's just a skip away from Manhattan, where the record was released last week. And you know, if you could make it there, if you'll make it, like they say, you'll make it anywhere. That market in the east part of the country, New York, Philadelphia, Boston, is really the center of that dance music. And I'm very excited about it, actually. When I heard about it today, I was very excited.
Well, I should think so. The song was a week released. The 08 release was just a week ago, and it's charting at number 3 there at the Mass Pool. So how many weeks does this charting run? In other words, how long do you have to wait to see which way it goes?
Well, actually, the record started shipping out, the CDs, rather, started shipping out mid-June. We tried our best to get it everywhere for Gay Pride, and it was shipped directly to 1,000 gay clubs across the United States. And I believe Mass Pool, which is one of 15 record associations that are promoting this record, they probably distributed it only about 2 weeks ago to its members. They have about 55 dance clubs in their association. And for it to chart this quick, it entered at 33 on the top 60. For it to get that sort of a charting position, it must be in the top 20 of most of the clubs they're ready. That's extremely fast. They usually chart these records for about 8 to 16 weeks, depending on the pool. And so before they, you know, introduce new music, because they want to keep the – it doesn't mean the record's not being played anymore. But this is the first charting of possibly – we're probably going to see this on the chart for the next 12, 16 weeks at least.
Well, Vincent, I've been trying – go ahead, please.
Go ahead. But again, this is just one record pool. There are 14 others from Los Angeles to Vancouver – from Atlanta to Chicago. All of the big markets have distributed this CD within the last 2 weeks.
Well, that's, of course, amazing. I have a point of curiosity. When I'm looking at the actual chart from Masspool, and it's charted at 33, which is an ad. It's a brand new, it's charted for the first time at 33, which you said. But it lists both I Am What I Am and I Will Survive. Are we saying that both those tracks are charting that high?
You know, that is a mystery. I don't know. I don't know which of the tracks is charting or if they're both charting. You know, they both have, I feel, the potential to chart, but I don't know which one is charting. And I wish I knew, but I really don't know.
Well, they're both quite wonderful, and they both have a lot of what I can only call personal energy. Songs like I Am What I Am being gay anthems, if you will, and I Will Survive, of course, was a gay anthem when Gloria Gaynor did it. There's a lot of Vincent Capretta personally involved in those songs. It's not just a cover, it's a statement, as our friend Glenn Rivera put it. How did you come to choose those songs? Do they have personal meaning for you?
Well, they do have personal meaning. The I Am What I Am you reach that point in your life, especially when when you live our lifestyle, that you just have to say, I accept myself for what I am, and you put yourself out there, and you really get to the point where you don't really care what others are thinking. You need to live your life the way that you choose. And then, of course, the I Will Survive, I'm a survivor. And I think that is the key with any of us out there. We have to be able to survive. And, of course, both of these songs, Gloria Gaynor, of course, is no longer with us. And I wanted to make sure that music kept going. And it has an updated sound. And many of the DJs and youngsters that are now 18 years old hitting the clubs or 20, 25, some of them have never heard this material. So this is new stuff to them.
What a loss. And how wonderful that you are keeping it alive, which is one of the goals to. Yeah, there's a time that this, Glenn says that this music lives again, and that time is now. I'd love for the listeners to hear I Am What I Am track, which we have loaded at the studio, and I think that they're going to be quite amazed when they hear a singer who was in music school at 7 years old and later moved on to opera, what a singer like that can do with I Am What I Am. So, Bob, if you would roll that track for us, please. absolutely fabulous. And as Bob in production just pointed out, what a set of pipes. I've got to tell you, that is just amazing.
Pants that day when I sang that track.
Yes, yes, you do we still, do we have you on the line?
Oh, yes, yes, go ahead.
Okay, good, good. I was concerned there for a second. I didn't see my lights flashing, which fascinate me and sometimes lull me into a state of stupor. In any case, it is an amazing track. Of course, it has the new sound, the completely electronic sound to it, but the song is sung with such conviction. Are you going to do a music video of this?
We're hoping Glenn Rivera is going to help us out with that. We're going to put that all in his hands. And I'm looking forward to heading out to California to work with him on this. And God only knows what I'll look like after it's finished. But I told Glenn when I spoke to him, I said, whatever you want to make me look like, you know, I'm game. So I have no idea what he's conjuring up out there. But I trust him emphatically, so I'm sure it'll be fun.
Oh yes, yes. Glenn is quite skilled and has seen some of the videos of the equipment being used, and you can see some of the equipment. It's all very professionally done and well done. Glenn is certainly someone who loves the music and certainly can be trusted. Have you personally thought about wardrobe for it, though? What are your own thoughts?
Well, I have thought about some things, but again, I'm going for shock value, you see. And again, but what I'm thinking about and what Glenn may have in mind may be two different things. But I can see myself in a nice teddy with some fishnets and some high stilettos. It's something as outrageous as you can think of.
I see. Well, and quite rightly, of course, with the things that are, and quite rightly, you just about have to do that anymore.
You really do. You know, I don't want to be, when you're doing drag, everybody wants to be beautiful. I want to be outrageous. I want people to remember me when they see me, in their nightmares even.
Well, that's certainly a broad spectrum show then, if it covers that wider range, and I understand that.
Like I said, I'm putting myself completely in Glenn's hands out there. And we're going to let him and his entourage out there create from their perspective what they, you know. I've sung the track, you know, and I've done my part. Now it really is up to someone else to create the rest.
Well, I think the singing is fabulous. The singing is also fabulous on the I Will Survive track, which we'll run for you a little later in the show. It's quite amazing, really, and you couldn't have chosen two better songs when you consider the climate that's going on in the country these days. It's the sharp divides and the sharp cutting remarks from the far right. These are two anthem songs that need to be reborn, as best I can tell you.
Well, you know, when you go out clubbing at night, you want to forget about everything that's going on in the world. And these two songs make you feel good. So when you're out there dancing, even if it's just for that 5 minutes or so, you're in a different world and you feel good, and it's meaningful to you. It gives you that motivation. It makes you feel good about yourself when you walk off that floor, and that's what it's all about. And there's and it does bring back that ambiance of disco that the newer kids out there don't know. So hopefully this will really just take off and become what it was to us back, you know, in the early 80s.
Well, Vincent, we'll come back, and I hope it does, because it was and still is everything to us, those of us who remember those days. And we'll come back to the music shortly. I want to point out that The toll-free line, should you like to call in and talk with Anthony, I'm going to confuse that throughout the show, Vincent, because your father, Anthony Capetta, and your Vincent Capetta, so I have two first names, which I'll ask you to explain shortly. But the toll-free line is 877, the number 4, head-on, or that translates into 877-443-2366. If you have unlimited long distance, you could use that. It's 304-658-3333. Email arrives to Peter at headonradionetwork.com. Well, now tell us about faith. This is apparently something that you don't just, at least in my experience, you just don't come up with it later in life. It's something that you bring with you and that gets battered and kicked about, and we have to hang on to through all of the years. And you are indeed Father Anthony Capetta. So, tell us about that. Amazing to me.
I was raised in a very devout Roman Catholic family, and I love Christianity. I don't necessarily love the some of the aspects that the church has done throughout its history, but I love the whole person of Jesus and what Jesus stood for and what he was here to teach. And ever since I was a young person, at the age of 12 actually, I was they attempted to enter me into the minor seminary at the age of 12. At that time, they used to take, you actually spent your 4 years in high school in the seminary. During my attempt to leave toward the seminary, it closed that year because of the lack of enrollment. Not, you know, of course, there aren't many people rushing to get into the seminary. But I have always had a desire to serve the church. And so that is a very difficult thing to explain to people, and so I'm not going to. It's difficult for me to try to explain it other than the calling that someone has, that constant desire to want to do something never leaves you. And so since the young age of probably 10 or so, or even younger, I had this inclination to serve the church. And that's now, of course, there have been many hurdles that you are aware from my history and obstacles that I have jumped through and over in order to get here finally. And of course, being openly gay, it didn't make things easier. But when you have a belief in something, and you want to share it, there's nothing better living for other than what you believe in, because that's who you are. That's what people are going to see. They're going to see you. They're going to see you by your actions, and that's the bottom line. So you can talk the talk, but you've got to walk. You know, you've got to do what you say. And my goal in life is to make people realize that everyone is loved by the Creator. And everyone is perfect in the Creator. And that's the center of my whole motivation toward the priesthood.
There are long years between the times when we first acquire a faith, and we are tested in many ways and we are battered in many ways. I personally went through a period of 15 years, very much addicted to cocaine, and during that period, I did some bad things. Never killed anybody, but I did commit financial crimes, and I spent some time behind bars for that, and have paid my debt to society. Thank you very much. And came back out and landed on my feet. This thing about the scandal and protest of the Roman Catholic Church. Vincent, what was that about? Were drugs taking? Were you? I mean, I'm getting personal, I know, but
yes.
Was this? Does it have to do with drugs? Because normally this sort of thing, it does.
No, not at all. Actually, what it was I had begun raising money by the mail in order to build an openly gay Catholic church. And that's what upset the Roman Catholic Church, is that I was soliciting on a national basis to Roman Catholics asking for money to support my endeavors. And of course, when you're that young and taking the direction of others, I did what I did to raise the necessary money I had to raise. And it's a very complicated case of what transpired. But the bottom line was, or is, in my opinion, the church was upset enough to want to stop me. And they contacted the officials, the federal officials, and made a case that I was misrepresenting myself as a Roman Catholic, being that I was appealing to Roman Catholic people. And this is where the mail fraud came in. Now, what the church neglects to tell you was that I was actually invested in one of their churches with permission of the diocese as a Franciscan at 18, as a Franciscan brother. And so when all of this was conjuring up, the church pretty much did not tell the whole story. So when I was raising the money through the mail from coast to coast, and I did offer to send it back. I wasn't permitted to do so. They pretty much, you know, I want to say, but you don't really know for sure. You know, it's, the theory is that if I wouldn't have been gay or openly gay, that a lot of this would not have happened. I don't know if that necessarily is true or not, but I do believe that the church was and is still ardently upset that I am an openly gay priest and that I teach that it is okay to practice, you know, this lifestyle. So there weren't any drugs involved. It was basically me asking for money. And as the money came in, the money was put into more mailings to be sent out. But being that my music career at the time was also running, it was in it. The church, of course, tried to make an issue that I was using the money from the appeals to further my rock music singing career, which really isn't the case at all, because if you know, in the music business, unless you're on the top of the charts, you're not making any money. So it's a very complicated issue of how it transpired and what actually took place, because all of the information was never really put out there. Things, you know, history is history. I ended up serving 3 years in federal prison in a camp with judges and doctors and lawyers and people of that nature for white collar crimes. And during that time, I was actually taking college classes and studying during those 3 years that I was there. And it was during that time that I completely abandoned Christianity. I decided no more of that for me. You know, I was always the good Catholic kid, never did anything wrong. And when I ended up going to prison because of something related to the church, it totally freaked me out. So when I came out of prison in 92, for 10 years, I pretty much sat without any notion of being ordained a priest. So this priesthood, my priesthood and my ordination to diaconate priesthood has only been since 2002. So I sat for 10 years totally lost and totally bewildered of what Christianity was or what it should be, and if indeed I was the right person to even be thinking about the ministry. So it gets very complicated. I mean, obviously, within the mailings, there was misrepresentation. Otherwise, I wouldn't have gone to jail, because that's what it was. You know, when you start raising that kind of money and you get excited about it, you just keep putting out the letter that works. And but again, there are lots of variables with what went on there. So it's very... You know, when people hear about this, they kind of say, gee, you know, this sounds crazy. But again, it happens. So what do? You know, you go to prison, you serve your time, and then you need to come out and you need to start over. And that is probably the most difficult time of starting over, because no matter how many good things you've done in your life or how much you have built yourself up, when you go to jail or you go to prison, it seems like everything you worked for is meaningless. So when you come out, it's like starting from ground zero. And when I came out with one box of clothes. That's all I owned. And from that point on, I decided that I wasn't going to be another statistic, that I would pursue my music, pursue my ministry, and actually do what I set out to do prior to the Roman Catholic Church, prior to all of that business with the Roman Catholic Church.
Well, Vincent, one wonders, had you been a heterosexual male who was fundraising to start another Roman Catholic Church, one wonders what the hierarchy is. How does the Catholic Church decide to build another church? And what would they do if you were a straight man? Would they have said, well, this isn't the way to do it, son. You need to do it this way, and that all's forgiven, and we love you? That's what I'm thinking.
Well, keep in mind, when I was invested as a Franciscan in their church, I'm speaking of using their church building, I was already connected with an independent Catholic group that had obtained permission to use their church for the ceremony. I wasn't a member of the Roman Catholic Diocese. I was an outside person who had been given permission to use their building. And, of course, that's part of the story they didn't release, the fact that they allowed me to use the church, that there were 300 people at the ceremony, that there was a reception there, and the whole bit. But to answer your question, if I would have been, if I would have been a Roman Catholic priest or a Roman Catholic layperson at the time raising money, yes, I probably would have just been heterosexual. I probably would have been just called into the bishop's office and slapped on the hand and told to hand over the money, and it would have been the end of it. But being that I was gay and in the news with my music, they made more of an issue out of it, and I hit, headline news. I hit Associated Press, Money Magazine, all of those major, they made a public figure out of me. For what, I don't know. But I do believe sexuality played a lot in it, but that's only a theory. You can't worry about it. You've got to take it for what it is or what it was, and you move on.
Well, Vincent, I have to say to you that the most important thing that you're saying, that you're not really saying, but I'm hearing, is the complete lack of anger in your voice. You're simply trying to present it in a way that people can understand, but I feel no resentment from you or anger.
Well, I did go through that period of extreme anger because when you grow up in any denomination, and especially if you're a faithful communicant, and I was a good Roman Catholic boy all through high school. I went to Mass every day. I was a altar boy the whole bit. You feel betrayed, and I do feel betrayed, and even as a homosexual male, I feel very betrayed by what the Roman Catholic Church continues to do and say about the gay community. So there is anger there, but the anger has to be dealt with, otherwise you can't be what would be the word I want to say? There will be no progress on your part if you allow the anger to take precedent. So, I've dealt with that aspect, and that's part of the 10-year silence, I think, that I had, where I completely abandoned Christianity in most aspects because I mistrusted the church. I mean, when we speak of the Christian church, I mean, you can't help but, Catholicism is the mother Christian church. I mean, Catholic Church is the Catholic Church. So, they tell you you're doing something wrong, you can't help but, think about it and say, well, gee, maybe I am, So it took a lot of time and reflection for me to realize that it's really not me that has the problem, that it's, there are just a lot of dinosaurs in places where they shouldn't be. And you just have to resolve that within yourself in order to be helpful to anybody else.
Vincent, help us to understand then the order of Catholicism that you were indeed involved in when all of this happened. I'm seeing now that you're part of the United Reformed Catholic Church International. Is this the same Catholic group that you were involved in at that time?
It's not the same group per se. It's the same movement. During the late 1800s, a group of Catholics, Romans, broke away after Vatican Council I in Europe. I don't want to get too technical because I'll lose the listening audience here.
We have an awfully smart audience. We have some of the brightest people. So
I'll move forward. I am part of what is known as the Old Catholic Church, and which I'm sure you're familiar with because you've interviewed old Catholic bishops. The old Catholics stem out of the Netherlands, and they, during the late 1800s, rejected papal infallibility and left the Roman Catholic Church and continued their branch of Catholicism with some changes, one including married clergy. They permit divorce. Divorce is an issue, and at that time they abolished confession as a mandatory element as far as the receiving of the sacraments. So the groups that exist today are all branches or offshoots of this old Catholic movement from the late 1800s, and that's what I'm part of. I actually am now part of the Apostolic Catholic Church out of Florida, Bishop Chuck Lay, Bishop Kimo Piave out of the United Reformed Catholic Church International is the bishop that ordained me in 2004, but I am no longer under his jurisdiction. I'm under Bishop Chuck Lay. But there are many different names that these groups have today, but basically they're old Catholics when it comes down to it. And old meaning they're not old people or they're not old-fashioned and they're not saying the Mass in Latin. What it means simply is that they are the Catholics prior to 1870 who refused to accept papal infallibility. And that's who we are. We're very Catholic, but we're very open-minded. And today our churches, our branch of Catholicism, we ordain women. We have women priests. We marry gay couples. Birth control and divorce is not an issue to us. Those are all things we leave up to the conscience of the person. So, as you see, we're very different than the Roman Catholic Church socially. But when it comes to sacraments, we still offer all seven sacraments of the Church. But there's one key element that separates us from the Roman Catholic Church. We don't discriminate. We offer the sacraments to you, to any Christian, regardless of your denomination, without any hindrance, because we feel that that's our job. Our job is to give the sacraments that Jesus gave and not to make them unattainable. So we're not out to judge anyone. We're out to provide. I hope that helps answer some of the questions you're asking.
Well, these are marvelous explanations, and you're doing a beautiful job of conveying this to folks. And yes, in fact, we have had members of the old Catholic Church. We had Bishop Bruce Simpson on the show, and he told us about the old Catholic Church. What's fascinating to me, Vincent, is that since that split, when the old Catholic Church formed, it almost is reminiscent of the Protestant churches, where there's different brands, so to speak, of Protestant churches. How many different offshoots or brands might there be of the old Catholic Church? If you're a member of one of them, how many might there be?
Many. Too many. The only saving element of it is that our priests and bishops have remained an apostolic succession to the Pope, to the Rome. That's what makes us different from Protestantism. Protestants have no connection to the Roman ordinations, whereas old Catholics have remained very steadfast in that without breaking that. So we're very similar to Anglicanism or Orthodoxy, Episcopal we all maintain the apostolic succession. However, similar to the Baptist Church, for instance, there are many different independent old Catholic churches under different bishops, and so we're not set up the same way as we don't have one. There may not be our churches are so small to begin with. Generally, our parishes, a bishop could be five states away, versus having a bishop in your own state, and you may have a bishop in your state that is actually not even affiliated with you, that is old Catholic, and you're still affiliated with someone outside of your state. So the old Catholicism was almost extinct in this country until the onset of the Internet. It was very strong at the beginning of the 19th century, or 20th century, during the early 1900s when the immigrants came over from Europe. Because the initial old Catholics were Germans and Austrians and Swiss and Dutch, and then they because of the sizes of the congregations, and our congregations are very poor, and we are not paid. Our clergy, most of us, I would say 99% of us across the United States, are volunteers. It was very difficult to survive, and of course, the Roman Catholic Church would set out to make sure that. Was they did discover us, that they would make sure that we didn't exist either. So with the onset of the Internet, advertisement is free. And people are now becoming more and more aware of these independent Catholic groups around the country, and they still do remain relatively small. And so it is a full-time job raising money, just like it is to keep your radio station going, for us to keep going. Because there are only a handful of us. Wherever we go, there's a handful. But at least we're here. So, people come to me all the time and say, I'm agonizing that I can't receive the sacraments, and I'm so glad you're here to give them to me. So it's just that one person that can walk through the door on Sunday Mass, and say, I'm so glad you're here, that makes it all worthwhile. And I'm sure it's the same way with reaching a gay or lesbian, transsexual, bisexual listener, transgendered listener, someone who's out there lost saying, I can't connect. And hearing the radio station, same thing with the church. They find you. They feel they have a connection. They feel that there's somewhere where there's a safe haven for them to come to. And that's the whole gist of it, really. That's what keeps us going around here.
Vincent, we have such a wide range of listeners. We have Wiccans, and we have Jews, we have atheists, we have Methodists, Baptists, you name it. That being the case, many people may not understand or have a good understanding anyway of what apostolic succession is. Could you explain that to us, please?
What that means is that our ordinations begin, the Catholic Church believes that Peter was the first apostle. That Peter was the first pope. Jesus had 12 apostles. All of them were ordained priests by the onset of the Holy Spirit during Pentecost. And the church believes that Christ appointed Peter his first pope of the church. And up until the 15th century, there was only one church, the Catholic Church, only one Christian church, until we had the break of Lutheranism in the 1500s. And so the Catholic Church pretty much controlled the world for 1500 years since the time of Christ. And what it means is that our ordinations have never broken line. So when Peter ordained his first priest and so forth and so on, that laying of hands has never been disrupted. So my ordination can be traced all the way back to Peter. And that's the key element with apostolic succession. Anyone who's in apostolic succession, we are the preservers of the sacraments of the church that were initiated by Christ to the apostles. I hope that helps.
Yes, it does. And so what I'm hearing you say then is that when the break occurred between Roman Catholics and the old Catholics, there was really no break in apostolic succession, only a break in other areas, or in other words.
That's correct. There was never a break. Of course, several bishops left at that time, too. Now, the way the Roman Catholic Church views our ordinations is that they are valid but illicit. Illicit because they are done without the permission of the Vatican. But they are valid because the apostolic succession has never been broken.
I see.
So, you know, we don't particularly care what the Vatican says. That's why we are here.
And what a here you are. I've got to tell you, you're an amazing character. I completely was not aware that the thing that happened, the controversy with the fundraising was on Money Magazine and CNN and all that. I guess I thought it was kind of a local thing. Apparently, there's a newspaper in Ohio called Plain Dealer, and they seem to have produced many headlines about you. And I began wondering about it because it seems that in 1988 they did an article on you. It says, in any guise, Brother Anthony Capretta, a dance rock singer, is an enigma. It was probably a complimentary article. And it seems to me that in 1989, when this situation started, they turned vindictive on you, because at that point it was 1, 2, 3, 4, article after article, Capretta pleads guilty, Capretta pleads not guilty, mail fraud. You know, what was the deal with the Plain Dealer?
Well, the Plain Dealer is the largest newspaper in the state of Ohio, and it reaches probably a reading audience of maybe 3 to 4 million people. And basically what happened, I was called by one of their writers, and she said, I was known as Brother Anthony at the time. She said, I've heard of all these wonderful things you're doing. She says, I would like to do an article on you. Unbeknownst to me, she was sent as a setup from the Federal Bureau of Investigation and from the Roman Catholic Diocese and Better Business Bureau. And she came, she interviewed me for a couple of hours, she took photographs, or she brought a photographer, we showed her all the things we were doing, and so forth and so on. And at that time, I happened to have had a number one record on Cleveland Radio. It was called the Cleveland Browns Tank. It was something that was a promotional tool for the Cleveland Browns football team. And so everyone in town knew who I was. And I was out at a disco one night, and somebody ran up to me on the floor and said, you better get out of here. You're on the front news. You're on the headlines of the Sunday morning paper. And sure enough, on the Sunday, the headlines of the paper, it had me as a priest, or in my Roman collar as a brother. And then the other side of the picture was me in drag. And it said the two faces of Brother Anthony. And from there, it went on and on and on. And from that moment on, it was headline after headline after headline. And I believe they were probably trying to discredit me, which they were trying to do, because I had never done anything. You know, I was always known as a community organizer and goody two-shoe, you know. So that was just the beginning. But many newspapers, you know, the Catholic Church, the Roman Catholic Church, had disclaimers sent out about me from coast to coast to every diocese. I was in
there. We're not affiliated with this drag queen disco singer.
Right. They were calling me the rock singing Franciscan. I can't even remember the things they called me, you know. So when you're a young kid, I was only 26 years old, 27 years old, still that young. When all this stuff's happening to you and people are following you with cameras, and, I mean, they knew my every move, everywhere I was, you know, it's still frightening, you know. It's like the paparazzi. So I can't explain the feeling. It was just insane, absolutely insane. But I have to say, here in Columbus, Ohio, which is now the largest city in the state, they did a wonderful two-page article on me in their paper a couple years ago, and it drew nothing but positiveness. And they laid it all out. And they were, I think, expecting a negative reaction from the Roman Catholic Church, but not one word was said. So, I do know that there were articles about me throughout the Associated Press and Money Magazine, some other major avenues. when all of that took place. And now I'm hoping they're going to write about me again, you see. Now that I'm doing something exciting again, you see.
Well, Vincent, my heart goes out to you. I mean, having been on the other side of the law myself, I mean, that's bad enough. But I didn't, at least I didn't have newspapers writing countless articles that about Luxinger does this, and the national coverage. You were really in the eye of the storm there.
And I don't even understand why. That's, you know, even my attorneys could not understand why they had made me such a figurehead, such a public figurehead during all of this. I mean, I was just a nobody, you know, and, but I think in the long run, I've had offers for book writings and everything, and I've turned everything down because I'm just not ready to do all that yet. But I think in the long run, it's going to work in my favor. Because they've said all they can say. And I'm not ashamed of telling the story. So that's why, as you see, the news releases that are sent out from the record label pretty much tell it all. And I'm, you know, that's just me.
Well, I want to tell you there's an email from our friend Larry Sanders. Larry is one of the first-generation DJs who played on Fire Island. He says, please tell Vincent, having been a DJ on Fire Island as well as Flamingo, which was the predecessor of the Saint, I have complete empathy for what you went through in regards to individuals who undermined and cut your throat at all costs for self-gain. He also says he'd like to ask, aside from the duties of the priesthood, might your recording sessions lead to covers of 70s classics as Ride the Mighty High by the Mighty Clouds of Joy? Yay, one of my personal favorites. And Oh Happy Day by the Edwin Hawkins Singers. And he also says he doesn't think there's ever been a cover of Ride the Mighty High, which is, of course, awesome. I remember playing that myself, and Larry does too. It's a gospel track that crossed over to disco and peaked in 1976.
Well, you tell him to produce it, and I'll come and sing it. He does the track, and I'll come and sing it. No charge. I'll just be there to sing it, and that's a promise. But there's one important aspect that I haven't mentioned, which you haven't brought up, is that I was diagnosed in 1999 with HIV, and it was during that year that the... when I came out of prison, I totally lost faith in Christianity. It was during that year that I was diagnosed that all of the fear of what the repercussions would be if I were to go back in the ministry left me. And I don't know what it was, but I just complete peace within myself to continue what I had set out to do before I was stopped. And that was a spiritually turning point for me. I wasn't freaked out that I was diagnosed at all. I was actually somewhat relieved because I didn't have to worry about going and getting tested anymore every 6 months. I kind of took it kind of pretty good, I think. But it did change my perception of what I felt the rest of my life should be directed toward. And it was toward, you know, completing the objectives that I had set out to do prior. So that's something I do want to interject before, you know, we forgot about that.
Well, certainly that diagnosis, which I have also, changes your way of thinking. For me, it was sort of like, well, I'm not afraid of the monsters anymore. I'm facing this monster, and it's the biggest monster that you could possibly throw at me, so whatever you're going to do is kind of irrelevant. It gave me a whole different perspective.
You're absolutely right. I mean, you know, of course it's no longer a death sentence, and, you know, you can live a wonderfully productive life, and I'm very healthy, thank God, and, you know, and I do what I need to do. But it does make you think that, you know, what else can they do to you? You know, everyone's gonna die one way or the other, and that's the worst thing that can happen, I guess, if you look at it that way. I actually look forward, just because I know there's somewhere else to go better. But it does change your perspective on what your contributions to society should be while you're here. And so that is another turning point. So there are so many, like I said, there's always a glitch somewhere. There's always another hurdle to jump. There's always something, you know, something can change tomorrow that makes you have to turn around and go the opposite way. And it's whether or not you're going to get, you know, whether you're going to be able to do it or not. You know, that's the thing. You have to push yourself to just go.
I understand completely. And what a war story that is, though, the pills and the and the side effect. But, you know, it's a small price to pay to keep your life, eh?
If you enjoy your life, it is. It really is. I mean, yes, you have to take the medicine every day and the perception of you. I mean, that's why I'm still single. I can't get a date. You know, I joke with Glenn Rivera all the time. I said, find me a husband.
Now, if anybody could do it, look out what you ask for, because if anybody could do it, Glenn can.
You know, it's a double whammy, you know. If people ask me, of course, you know, they don't know, you know, if I meet someone, they don't necessarily know who I am. But, you know, first you hit them with the HIV thing, and then you hit them with the priesthood, and then you're done. I mean, they run. So, and
you are kind of scary, Vincent.
Well,
loves you nonetheless.
But, so I know there has to be a man out there somewhere, you know.
Oh, what a hoot. Vincent, tell us about the community of charity, the church that you're involved in, and the works that you do, and also, by all means, what they think of your singing career and all the things you've been through.
Well, we are a very small congregation in Columbus, Ohio. There are about 12 of us, and we're only 4 years old. Everyone is quite aware. Most of the congregation is heterosexual, believe it or not, and they're very supportive because they know that if anything major should happen with my music, that I'm going to send the money over to the church. So they're very excited about it. So, you know, people can go to our website at communityofcharity.org, and it tells you the history of what we believe. It tells you what we believe in the history of the old Catholic Church. But our apostolate here really is to help people. We are a very small provider. So if someone, for instance, is short on their rent or can't pay their electric or have lost their job or needs food, people contact us every week, and we do what we can. We help them until our funds run out. And so that's the goal. The goal is to just help as much as you can. So we're always raising money here. We have yard sales, basically. You know, I'm not sending out any more mail. You know, no money, raising money in the mail. But we are selling, you know, yard sale items. And so we work year-round preparing for our yard sale, which we just finished one 3 weeks ago. We had 2,000 people come through. And so we really have grown a wonderful reputation for our sales. But the community is, like I said, a very small group. We have Mass on Sunday, and we're a family. And they think I'm as weird as can be, you know. But they enjoy the openness here. We're a very philosophically open group. I don't talk to people. I talk with them. We sit. Our service is done in the round. We sit in the round. We share the readings as a group. You know, I'm part of the group. I'd like to be known as maybe the group leader, but that's to the extent. You know, I'm there to be amongst the family. So, but going to communityofcharity.org really will give you a good insight. And, of course, you'll be able to see where I live because the manor house is listed there, and that's where I reside. And that in itself is another story. So that's for another issue.
Well, first, regarding the charity and helping folks out regarding paying the rent or keeping the electric going or the heat, what have you, I understand that you don't limit that to the LGBT community. My understanding is that you freely offer this to heterosexual couples. There are no boundaries there.
No, absolutely no boundaries. as long as you live within the state of Ohio, because we are an Ohio incorporation, you are eligible. You simply write a letter to the church explaining your need and why you need it. Of course, not everyone is approved because we don't have the funds, but we try to take the most needy that we can help. And it makes no difference what religion you are or aren't or anything. We're here to help people. And I'll tell you, with the economy, the calls are twice as many this year as they were last year, and we expect a very heavy holiday request coming up with the holidays. So that's what we're kind of getting ready for now. Last year we helped several families, but again, there's only so much, you know, a group like ours can do. So we are a referral service as well. So if we can't help someone, we point them in the direction of someone that we think may be able to help them.
Well, Vincent, is there a conscious outreach of the group to reach out to the LGBT community? Most of your members being heterosexual, I think that's absolutely wonderful. And what a paradox that you're all together. That's absolutely wonderful. What do you have discussions about why the LGBT community seems to lack an interest in these things? This is, of course, a very broad brush I'm painting
right.
with.
I can tell you, I have been through, Columbus is one of the largest gay communities in the country. It's per capita, they claim now to be second only to San Francisco. And we have, I believe, 35 gay bars here. I've been in every one of them. I've flyered every one of them. I sing karaoke everywhere I can go. Everyone knows who I am. They know I'm here. The gay community has been so hurt by organized religion that no matter what kind of priest you are, they most of them turn and walk the other way. They feel that, you know, when they see me, that I'm judging them, or that, you know, or they, even though they feel I may not be judging them, they still see the authority of the church in front of them, and I don't blame them because I've been through it. You know, so we do our very best to make sure that they know that we're here, and that everyone's accepted here. You know, you can come in your jeans, your T-shirts. I have a wonderful lesbian couple that come here. I've never seen them in a pair of pants. I mean, I've never seen them in a skirt either. They're always in, you know, tear-off shirts and jeans, and they're just cut-off shorts. But again, all you can do is allow people to know you're here. You can't force them. Spirituality, from what I have found, is something that people will seek out. And when they're ready, they'll look for it. And that's what we're here for. We're here to make sure that when they are looking, they know we're here. And we do advertise. And there are other gay and lesbian-oriented churches in town, of course, as well. So I think the gay and lesbian community here has plenty of choices.
Do you, in the meetings, do you typically sing old Catholic hymns or the older hymns, or do you do some more modern music? One wonders, because our friend Larry, who I just read you the email, sent me some information today when it came up that you were going to be on the show regarding, how can I put it, raves. You know, the traditional meaning of the word, the raves, the huge parties, the dancing. But apparently there are rave masses happening now.
You know, there's everything you can think of to get people to go to church. And I'll tell you, I'm one of those priests that's not into all that. I mean, I'm more of a conservative priest when it comes to the liturgy, I have to say. My congregation does choose its music. If they even choose to sing, a lot of times they prefer a silent mass without singing, and they can choose whatever kind of music they'd like. Whatever moves them. If they want to dance, they want to sing, whatever the case may be. But as a person, I would say I'm more on the conservative side of worship as far as our mass, of course, is in English. But I'll leave the jazz and rave and techno masses to someone else that can mentally handle it. I'm from the old school as far as that goes.
Well, regarding your relationship with the Reverend Lee, who is apparently now, is he the bishop? Is that the title?
Chuck Lee?
Yes,
he is the presiding bishop of the Apostolic Catholic Church in Florida. And my association with him is very new, actually. I just went to his jurisdiction within the last month. He is now our protecting bishop, which means he's our spiritual guru. He provides sacraments that I cannot provide. A priest can do most of what needs to be done, but a bishop is needed for certain things like confirmations or holy oils and such. And he is there to guide us. But again, my relationship with Chuck is relatively new. I met him about a year ago, and I really enjoy his work. He, too, has spent years in prison, some time in prison, and that's what drew me to him. He's a very educated man. He is the president of the Florida Council of Churches and very involved with all of the denominations of Christianity and even outside of Christianity. So he's much more involved with that political scene than I am. I'm more of a homebody priest. You know, I enjoy my quiet little parish, and all the drama I prefer to keep away from the church. So when people come to us, it's a quiet little haven, and we try to leave the politicking outside, because the church is very political, as you know. It can be very political.
Yes, this is fascinating to me. Both of you having been in prison, it almost seems very close following of John, or Paul, rather. Paul was in prison.
Really a very brilliant person, and Bishop Keawe in Hawaii is heterosexual. So is Chuck. They're both married. They're both heterosexual bishops that took upon a gay priest or a gay candidate for priesthood. And of course, even doing that was a big jump for them, because they're questioned of their motives. They have other bishops to answer to. And they've both been, both Bishop Kimo and Bishop Chuck have been very supportive of both my music and my sexuality and the direction that this parish has taken. And they think I'm as crazy as a loon, but they know I'm serious. They know when business has to be taken care of, that it's going to get done. And there's time for play, and there's time for religion, and there's, time for study, and I'm always studying. And, but they're good. They really are good people, really.
Vincent, I have an email from one of the listeners who's asking a question. They recall early in the conversation, I pointed out that you were called Pinky to the fellow inmates while you were in the federal prison. How were you treated there by the other inmates? Was that... I assume they knew you were gay. What was that like for you is the question. And the other part of the question is, why the difference, Vincent Capretta and Father Anthony Capretta? So there's two questions there.
Well, let's answer Pinky first. The name.
Okay.
When I self-reported to prison, which was in Indiana, I was actually in three different institutions because of the media. They kept shipping me elsewhere, but I started in Terre Haute, Indiana. Everyone knew I was coming already, because there was a large Italian contingency there, so the mob knew I was coming. They knew the new Italian boy was coming in. I had a pink swatch on my arm that I refused to take off, and the officer said to me, "You're going to be teased about this if you wear this." I said, "I want to wear it." So that's how it became known as Pinky. And from that moment on, I had pink everything. The inmates made sure I had pink pillowcases, pink shoes. I had pink tennis shoes, pink everything. Drove the warden insane. And so that's how it was known as Pinky. And that can be a movie and a book in itself, because there were so many incidents that took place in there. It was hilarious. They treated me extremely well, actually. The administration at each of the three institutions felt that I shouldn't have been there to begin with. So, and they were very candid about it. They said, we don't believe you should be here, but you're here, so we're going to make it as easy as possible for you. They gave me nice, cushy little jobs. I was the head of the laundry, and I was the organist for the chaplain, and sort of things like that. So I taught music while I was there. And getting to your other questions, Vincent is my birth name, and Anthony is my patron saint. I'm a big fan of St. Anthony of Padua, who is the patron saint of lost articles and other things. St. Anthony was a very educated Franciscan priest who was known also as the pounder of heretics. He gave fire and brimstone sort of speeches, you know, in the medieval ages in Europe. And so I've always had a devotion to St. Anthony of Padua. So when you become a priest or a religious, you have a choice to change your name. So I am known as Father Anthony Capretta in the church, and Vincent Capretta to people who I've grown up with or who know me in the music world.
Well, it seems to me that very interesting, and the story about Pinky, it almost seems as if you were adopted by the inmates, if they were making sure you had pink shoes, and you were sort of the brother. How did that go?
I had the most beautiful pink tennis shoes, and to top it all off, they made me cheerleader pom-poms that were pink that were on the tennis shoes.
My star.
So when I came prancing through the halls, you know, I will never forget one day the warden stopped me and said, where did you get those shoes? And I said, well, Dorothy gave them to me, of course. And he just shook his head and walked away. The next week later, I was on the bus out to my new destination, South Dakota. But the inmates, they really did like me. I was never in any dangerous situations. Of course, I was in a camp. You know, we had golf and tennis and swimming. It was really ridiculous. I lived better there than I lived at home. But they did take good care of me there, and I had a boyfriend all the way through prison, openly, at each institution. Never once were we disturbed or threatened or bothered by anyone. Actually, the guy that I was with was kind of scary anyway, so no one bothered us to begin with.
What a story.
This is a movie. I'm telling you, this is a movie.
It is.
And, you know, the book and the movie should be called From Prison to Priesthood. That's what it should be.
Yes, it would make a wonderful contrast to this, what is it, the cross, the switch, the cross blade and the cross, or the switch and the cross. What was the old movie? Cross and the Switchblade, that's what I'm trying to call it.
Now, that's
an old,
that's old now.
Yeah. So
give me your age now. No.
Well, you know, I don't think many of the listeners really comprehend how profound that is, that in the prisons they were telling you that they didn't think that you should be there. They were
right.
You made the now that really is astounding, because whether you realize it or not, in prison environments, federal, state, jail, the whole idea is that you're supposed to be there. And if you say you're not supposed to be there, it's because you're denying it. You're denying what you did. Everyone's guilty, and it's the opposite. You're guilty until proven.
They felt that the punishment was overly severe for what had taken place, I think. And being that, of course, I was a nonviolent offender, they knew that even by telling me that I wasn't supposed to be doing it, I wouldn't have done it again. But, you know, the church was trying to make a point, and they made an example out of me. And, I pled guilty because the government threatened to indict all of my board of trustees, which were 10
people. I see. That's how the plain dealer or whatever that newspaper was saying. He pleads guilty. He pleads innocent.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
That's what it was all about, because, you know, they wanted me. That's what they wanted me. And so I certainly wasn't going to, you know, bring somebody else down with me. It was, for what reason would that, for what good would that do? But again, prison was not, and I don't mean to say this in a disrespectful way, but it was not a bad experience for me. I learned more in prison with the people that surrounded me than I've learned in college. because I was surrounded by doctors and lawyers and judges and congressmen that were very educated people. I spent most of my time in the law library researching cases and helping to file appeals and such with for others. And, of course, being in school, it was a tremendous learning experience. And what you do is you learn from other people's mistakes. And that's, you know, instead of plotting and planning something else to do, you sit there and you analyze and say, but, gee, if you would have done it this way, it wouldn't have been illegal. But, of course, you know, that's the story itself. But, you know, I certainly don't recommend that people set out to go to the next federal prison.
Yeah. We have another email, a question for you from another listener who's asking me to. It says, please ask Vincent if he's heard of Matthew Fox, who is an ex-Catholic priest.
I have not. Keep in mind that the old Catholics really have no communication with Roman Catholic priests. They're totally separate. There is not any love between the Roman Catholic Church and the old Catholic Church in this country. Now, if the Pastor Fox was an old Catholic, I'm just not familiar with him at all. But sometimes people assume that because we are priests that we know each other, and that's not the case at all. There really is a lot of animosity in some ways between the different churches, which is crazy, but it exists, and it's something that we deal with every day.
I see. Well, I realize now why she's asking if you knew Matthew Fox, and I thought it sounded familiar when I read the email. Matthew Fox was one of my references regarding the raves, the mass, having a mass in the form of a rave and the dancing and the new music, and Matthew Fox is quoted as saying, I'm trying to wake up a sleeping giant, at which I would call mainstream Christianity. So apparently he is, that's probably what prompted her question. I knew I remembered that name.
Well, we're going to leave that up to Matthew Fox.
Okay. Yeah. You know, we can't go too much further into the show without addressing I Will Survive, which is an absolutely wonderful, and again, I use Glenn's statement that it's not a cover, it's more of a statement, it's more of a, I Will Survive really takes on a whole new meaning when I think the, which is why I've saved it toward the end, once the listener's got an idea of who and what you've been through, I think certainly I Will Survive will have a very different meaning for them, as it did for me. Tell us about the recording of I Will Survive. Did you record I Will Survive and I Am What I Am sort of at the same time, or were they, what was the progression?
Actually, no, two different times. And I Will Survive, the one that has been, this I Will Survive that's on there was actually released 20 years ago. And it has been remastered and put on this CD because of our feeling that the demographics of BJs have changed so much that they would not know the track. The track was done so well 20 years ago, it has been in storage in a pressing plant, an old record pressing plant, for 20 years, and we were able to get it out and have it remastered. So it was recorded actually 20 years ago. And so the I Am What I Am is the one that was recorded recently, and so even when you hear the voices, they sound exactly alike. My voice hasn't changed at all.
That's amazing.
I mean, I look a lot older, but, you know, a little powder and paint will make me what I ain't, I hope.
Well,
we'll leave that up to Glenn. But
yeah, that's Glenn's problem. He'll handle it.
But I was, you know, they did that track so well that I felt that it would be appreciated, released again, and that's why we really don't know which track is charting. And whether it's the remastering of the old I Will Survive that I've done, or if it's the new I Am What I Am, we have no idea.
It will be interesting in the next couple of weeks. Please drop me an email what you know, and it will be interesting if they both start charting separately next round. It wouldn't surprise me in the least.
Oh, absolutely.
And so the listeners can hear Vincent Capretta's version of I will survive. It's exceptional. I'm glad you know what you know about Vincent so you can hear it with different ears. Roll it, Bob. I will survive. Amazing.
The audience will tell you which one they like better. I don't know myself.
Well, I have to tell you, I've been chair dancing while the track was running, and I have absolutely no idea what I was going to ask you after we came back to the track because I was listening to the track. It's great stuff. It's hard to know which one they're charting.
I don't know, it was my decision to have it remastered because I felt it had such potential. You know, the market, as you know, it repeats itself. And this is the time. This is the time I thought it would be good to bring that sound in, and it seems to be working.
Well, I can't see how any DJ wouldn't play. They're just both fabulous. Of course, you know, going back to the day, I wonder if my view is colored, but for it to enter at number 33, all of a sudden, apparently it has the same effect on the crowds these days as it did. And well done. And what I remember now, this is, I totally lost it during me listening to the music, but I'm supposed to remember what I was thinking last. That's what the host is supposed to do. But anyway, what I was thinking was I was trying to imagine you doing that in drag as a black singer, as a black female vocalist, and you did your own lyrics. That must have been stunning. You did your own singing.
Well, you know, it's I don't even know how to explain it, to be honest with you. You know, it's all about the image. It's all about the just the mirage that you're creating for the audience. And but you know, when they can actually, when they really know that that sound's coming out of the person, it's so much different. But again, they can do anything today with makeup to make you look like whatever they want you to look like. And so, again, it'll be very interesting. I'm hoping that Ellen is listening to the show right now, so she can have me on the show. I can come out as a very conservative priest, and then 15 minutes later break through the walls, the ugliest looking guy you've ever seen.
Well, I have to tell you that I had not had you on the line, and having read about you today and talked to you today, there's no way that anyone could have convinced me that last track was not a black female vocalist. And I've got to tell you, you are good. And by the way, the line, "A little powder and paint can make me what I ain't," is absolutely fabulous. May I please have that to use it from time to time?
Absolutely, because I'm telling you, the older I get, the more they have to use. That's the problem.
Great, great line. You know, Vincent, we've talked about so many things, such a wide range of this evening, that it's hard to encompass it. I must tell you that you've made a wonderful impression on our chat room. They have absolutely loved listening to you and to the music. They are duly impressed by you. And I can always tell that, because often the chat room comes to a complete standstill when they're listening closely to the guest.
My one of my most favorite people is Judy Garland, and I do imitate her as well and sing. I do imitate her voice too, singing wise. And her line is, "I love you, I love you," and it's true. I love all you people out there. I'm so glad that you've taken the time to listen tonight and to come into my world a little bit. I know it's a little odd, but that's just me. And I hope that you'll run to your local DJ and say, "Please, please play this new Vince Capretta," you know.
Well, in closing, Vincent, I've asked you so many questions. Perhaps you'd like to talk to us about something that I haven't brought up. I often don't hit a topic that a guest would like. Is there something that you have on your heart that you wanted to say to the listeners that we didn't talk about?
Well, I think that there are so many things that we have talked about tonight that even I'm confused. But I don't, like I said, there are so many, when you are someone that is trying to put out a message, I think only in my own particular case, I think a lot of, there's so much negativity out there of what people perceive artists to be and people who are trying to make it in show business, but there really are a lot of good-hearted people out here that really do this because they love it. And I, for one, I'm very, very appreciative of people that can appreciate art for the sake of art, no matter what you do. And but there are so many things. You and I can stay on this line all night long. You know, we can go on and on. There's so much more that we haven't talked about that you need to know about. My God.
Well, which is why I'm going to drop a hint that we'd love to have you back at some time, because I have a feeling we have only brushed over the surface. I do want to ask about this, though, the house that's on the website.
Yeah.
That, yes, the manor house is an understatement, is very bad word. It's absolutely beautiful. In fact, I have to tell you, my first thought when I saw that on the website of the church, which, by the way, is communityofcharity.org, I thought, well, this is just sort of a house that they put up there that they got out of the real estate ad. You know, it was sort of a show house, you know, like a dream home or something. What is that place? Is huge. It's stunning. You live there?
I do live here, and I live here with my business partner, who I dated for 3 short months 10 years ago, and we've become like brothers. And we live here. There are 20 rooms here. There's 6,000 square feet. and it is called The Manor of Lady Jane Grey. We dedicated the house to Her Majesty in 2003. Now, Lady Jane Grey, for those of you that don't know, was the Queen of England in 1553 for 9 short days. And there's a whole history behind her. And the reason why we dedicated this house to her was because she was left basically with nothing. She was a very young girl who was given the throne by Edward VI, unknowing to her, and who was then put into the Tower of London by Mary, Queen of Scots, for a year before she was beheaded, basically because she refused to convert to Catholicism. She was an ardent Protestant, very well, very literate, educated young girl. And the more that I get into history, as you know, my third master's degree that I'm trying to complete now is ancient and classical history. I have a love for Tudor history. I must have been some queen some back, you know, some centuries ago, you know. And so everything here is very British and very, very Tudory and very regal. And we really do live in here. And the chapel is here on the second floor. It's a beautiful 1,000-square-foot chapel. And this is where they come for Mass. And so this too is a endless job, and I love to clean house, so I'm cleaning today.
You know, Vincent, I have to tell you, every question that I've asked you this evening, your replies have been so unexpected and absolutely fascinating. You've been an absolutely wonderful guest, and we really appreciate your being on the show this evening. And I owe Glenn Rivera a big hug for scheduling you. For being with us this evening. You made a huge impression on me, and what a wonderful, wonderful story. Thank you.
Well, my love goes out to everyone and to Glenn, and I hope that you'll see me on YouTube real soon with his rendition of whatever I'm going to look like next.
Absolutely. And God bless, and have a great evening.
You too. Good night.
Good night. Good night. Wow, kids. Absolutely wow. Who expected that? I mean, once I looked at his story, I knew it would be fascinating, but wow. Wow. I was just blown away. I don't remember when a guest has blown me away to this extent. Wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. Let me pull myself together and look at the schedule. Yes, tomorrow night we have DJ Larry Sanders scheduled at the gay bar across the street. Also, next Wednesday evening, we have Charles Robbins, who is the executive director of the Trevor Project, which is a suicide prevention hotline for the LGBT community. And this evening, we have a horn section coming up next with moi and Bob Kincaid and Mr. John Fox from Down Under, followed by a John Fox live presentation of All Fox Stuff at Midnight. So the programming is not over this evening on the Head On Radio Network. We've only just begun. So in closing, here's Cynthia Manley reminding you, too.